Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ja, men ja, då var det alltså dags för att dela en flaska igen. Den här gången har jag varit nere i Växjö. Jag tog bilen ner dit för att träffa Ruben Sanz Ramiro. Känner du inte honom så kan det bero på att han har spenderat största delen av sitt liv utomlands, bott i olika länder, född i Ribera del Duero. Han är hur som helst chefsommelier på Smålands bästa krog, en av Sveriges bästa krogar och en av Sveriges största vinkällare, PM och vänner. Och vi sitter där i ett hotellrum strax ovanför matsalen där han jobbar. Jag hoppas att ni hör allt vi säger och... om det inte skulle riktigt gå fram så går det alltid att spola tillbaka och lyssna en gång till. Hoppas ni tycker det blir kul att träffa honom. Han är en alldeles underbar människa och briljant sommelier. Nu rullar vi.
I'm very pleased to be able to say to you welcome. Welcome to PM and Banner. And welcome to Växjö, Småland.
Thank you very much. Does it feel like your new home?
Indeed, yeah. So I moved to Sweden from New York effectively the end of March last year. Even though I was already involved and with PM, and I was able to come to PM for a few times before.
And did you know the sommelier of PM, Andreas Larsson, before? Or
yes, of course. Andreas is world famous, and I had the opportunity to. First time I met him was in 2005. He was doing a lecture at a congress, the first congress in Ribera del Duero in Spain, which is actually the region where I'm coming from. And they did a first international congress in 2005, and he was one of the opponents. I think by the time he was like very sommelier of Europe, and he won quite a few competitions, and he was certainly well known then. And then after he became best sommelier in the world in 2007, certainly, I mean, he's a well-known figure in our profession.
Did you compete yourself at that time, or?
I never compete.
Never?
No.
Why?
I guess I'm not a competitive person, I suppose. I don't know. I never took that path. I guess that be able to start competing, it's also due probably if you are in the right context, in the sense that you have colleagues and that are competing, or you have a mentor that push you to compete and that. And I haven't really had that through my career. So I have a tremendous, tremendous respect and admiration for all of those that go through that path. And I have, at the same time, great hopes for one of our sommeliers here at PM & Banner, Johan Nilsson, who is part now of the Swedish sommelier team, and he's gonna compete in the upcoming Nordic challenge.
Yeah, he's very talented,
and he's fantastic. He's really, really, really good, and pretty much put all my energy and time in studying. And you know, I took the path of a master of wine and some sort of a different intellectual and study career, and that was not particularly that, because also I was surrounded by people who were in that particular process, and I have a great mentor. Her name is Lisa Granick, Master of Wine in New York. She inspired me very much to pursue that career, and that's what I did, basically. So, I mean, it's a combination of different things. I know so little of everything that I would like to learn and discover from the world of wine and beverages in general, that there is no reason for me to be, you know, proud of cooking about it, meaning in the sense that I wanted to be able to understand better what is wine. And, you know, I'm another passionate sommelier. I'm another passionate wine lover. And I'm another person who is there to trying to unveil the secrets and the mysteries of wine, basically. That's how I consider myself. And I will think, I must say that that's how I'm going to see myself for the rest of my life, because I don't think that life is long enough to be able to unveil all those secrets. No?
So that might be the reason why you started the Master of Wine studies.
Absolutely.
Because it seems to never end.
Yes, I did my first assignment for the first year, and I successfully passed it. And then I put the second year, which is the year then after you complete, you can set your exams, your final exams. I actually just put it on hold because it is a very demanding program and very demanding studies. And you really need to feel completely in control of your time and your life and being able to be fully grounded. And as you can imagine, after cross the Atlantic and moving from New York to Sweden, to Växjö, I'm still a little bit far from it. I'm learning through the day. So as soon as I am, I have that balance in life, I will certainly continue with it and be able to progress, hopefully.
I brought a bottle of red wine, and we're sitting here at PM Venner.
The wine is gorgeous. I was actually sitting here since you poured the glasses a few minutes ago. All the perfume aromatics coming out of the glass were taking over the room. I was just sitting here, and the aromas were just exhalating off the glass.
Yes.
It's very pretty. There's a lot of high tone aromatics and purity of fruit that makes this wine really attractive.
How do you usually approach a wine?
I would say, I mean, by the color you can tell that the intensity of the color is not very... It's not very profound, in the sense it's not deep, it's not opaque. It comes probably from a grape variety that doesn't have a high level of anthocyanins or tannins.
Yeah. No.
So that's the first hint that we will gather from it. Then the color, I think it can tell us a little bit, I would say, that just it might be going through a slightly process of developing quality, since the color is fading on the rim a little bit from ruby, just slightly. And that is often, as we know well, you know, caused through maybe a little bit of evolution of age on the bottle, but not necessarily. Some grape varieties, they are just like that, you know, like Sangiovese, Nebbiolo. Exactly. So I look at the wine also like food, in the sense that food is there, obviously, it's been there, traditionally speaking, to be enjoyed, but the taste, yeah? But when I look at a plate of food, I also, obviously, and everybody does that, of course, and the chefs, they want to present something visually attractive. And I like to smell the food before I'm eating it as well, because I think, you know, there is, it really offers you an extra dimension of what is going on in the plate.
Do you mind serving unfiltered wine without decanting it?
It depends. I mean, I think that if the wine do has a lot of deposits, I like to decant it. If I know that the wine is not going to suffer from the aeration. I don't mind myself drinking wine that has a lot of deposits. I don't mind, you know. The deposits normally, it comes towards the end, this is the last glass, you know, and it changes a little bit the texture of the wine. I am aware that the guests and many wine drinkers or consumers, as however we wanted to call them, some of them don't like that.
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, if I can, I try to serve them the cleanest wine as possible, because I know that is going to make them feel happier. And at the end, I'm here just to make people happy, you know.
That's your goal.
You know, I'm a sommelier in the service industry, and my studies, I studied hotel and business management initially in the Universidad Autónoma de Barcelona in Spain, in Catalonia. And the first day when we went to when we walked into the class, I remember that vividly. Our teacher says, okay, you know what you're here for. You're here because you want to become sales, happiness, people who sells happiness and people who make people happy. That's your final goal, you know? So, you know, that's what I'm here as well, you know, to make people happy.
But that's true, isn't it?
Indeed. I think that... sorry, I was actually...
You were in the wine, okay.
I was in the wine.
Cut. But I like that.
I'm very intrigued by this wine.
That's good. Yeah. I take it again, because my question wasn't totally clear either. Are there any additions on the menu tonight that you're really excited about? Any combination? All of them?
Yeah, of course. we change the dishes quite regularly. Chefs come up with pretty much menu changes for the bistro, for instance, every 4 weeks. And at the Matsalen, there are also changes every 4 weeks. And then for the tasting menu, they are happening even more frequently. And the reason behind is because the philosophy here at PM and Bannon is very clear. And it's... the chefs and everybody at PM are here to explore what Småland has to offer regarding its particularities of the terroir, and what is out there in the nature to offer to us. And we work with this, and we embrace what the nature gives us. And as the nature changes through the seasons, we change as well. Everybody kind of moves along with it.
Mm.
And from a wine perspective, I move along with it as well. So there are certain times of the year that I might be working more with this, a particular style of wines, because that's what the season is telling me to do so. And, you know, the chefs are extraordinary how they translate that into the plates.
Mm.
And I'm trying just to be a guest of it.
Mm.
You know, I'm trying just to disturb the least as possible through the choice of wines, mm-hmm. but trying to make, to enhance the dishes as much as I can. There is a constant conversation always with the chefs, and we discuss dishes, we taste them together, we taste wines together. You know, we see a small one at PM through the food, and I'm in the back seat. Mm. You know, they're driving the car. And,
has it always been like that when you've been working in other restaurants? Has the sommelier always been like in the back seat?
Not necessarily, no.
But you never start with a bottle of wine and create a dish. You usually go the other way around. Wait, for an example, if you find a fantastic bottle of wine, a sherry, for example, and you just walk up to the chef and said, can you just cook something so we can drink this?
Yes and no. I come into the position where, in certain occasions, I might have that bottle of wine in my mind, but I might suggest certain changes in dishes that I think it can be changed in order to fit that bottle of wine. I don't see myself as a... I don't create in the way that chefs do. I think chefs are the creators, are the ones that really, you know, they are the artists.
Mm-hmm.
I can have certain ideas about, okay, you know, this wine certainly works with this food, that food, and I think if we do this together, mm-hmm. but with the wine, when I'm cook at home, you know, mm-hmm. I have a bottle of wine and I want to drink, and then I might cook to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's not, I don't see part of my job as a sommelier to tell the chef what to cook, you know what I mean?
If we just take it back, I mean, you're born in a wine region, very famous wine region, Ribera del Duero.
Mm-hmm.
How was it to grow up in Ribera del Duero? I mean, it's a really specific wine region.
Mm. Well, this one is really nice. it was the reason why I'm here, I suppose, today. The curiosity of wine became... because I always had a bottle of wine at home.
Mm.
Back in my parents'...
Were your parents involved in the wine business?
Not directly. From my father's side, my family had vineyards. And my father, growing up, was working in the vineyards as well. And they did harvest and have... you know, people to come to the harvest and harvest the vineyards and all of that. So, I mean, they were growing grapes and they were selling them to a cooperative. That was the norm, you know, back in the 60s. And very few people were really making their own wine. You know, that was the norm in Spain, in Italy, many places around.
But you were never interested in that part of...
Yes, of course, I am. Yeah.
Now, but when you were a kid, when you were growing up, were you?
Because by the time I was born, all those vineyards were sold.
Oh, okay.
So I never really have a direct contact with wine growing myself.
See.
Only to, you know, wine as like, you know, as a child, have seen in my family always have wine, and I was very attracted by gastronomy. You know, my mom was an excellent chef, and you know, I spent a lot of hours with her in the kitchen, and you know, I was always there opening pots and tasting, and okay, you know, and that was to me fascinating. So for a long time, I was actually myself, I wanted to be a chef growing up, you know.
How old were you then?
Maybe like, you know, 10, 12, 13, all the way until, you know, when the decision came, I realized, well, there are also a lot of aspects around it that I don't want to really be a chef because, you know, I want to integrate wine into my work and the whole experience around it. So I didn't took that path.
Yeah.
And I, you know, sort of saw the whole gastronomy experience as a global unit. And that's why I ended up doing hotel and restaurant management studies and such. And then after that, specialized more profoundly in wine.
But you started the study in Ribera del Duero?
In there I did basic courses about, you know, wine tasting and, you know, and winemaking and shit and things like that. Basic, you know, introductory. I did more advanced studies when I studied hotel and restaurant management. When I left Ribera del Duero and I moved to Barcelona, and I studied there for 4 years. And then when I finished my studies, I realized that actually it was wine what I want to really work with exclusively, and I want to become specialized into. And then I moved to London.
Did you get a job in Barcelona before, or did you?
I was working during my studies. I was working for a really good catering company.
Okay.
Really, really good, actually. One of the greatest catering companies in Catalonia. We were doing events for, you know, all the politicians, all the upper class and greatest business in Catalonia. I mean, it was fantastic during 3 years. You know, I was studying and I was having that as a side job. So I was working maybe like 2 days, 3 days a week. And that was a great experience. But I never really worked in a restaurant during that time because, you know, I was studying, really. And
then you decided to go to London.
I decided to go to London. I went to London with one contact. I didn't know anyone.
A very reliable contact, though.
A very reliable contact, exactly. Yes. You know, you're fearless when you're young. I'm still fearless, you know. Yeah. I'm moving all the way from, you know.
Yeah, losing, risking everything.
Exactly. So, and London, I consider to be the capital of the wine trade in Europe. And I wanted to learn wine as much as I could and in a global level. So London was the only way for me.
So what did you study in London?
Yeah, so when I moved to London, I right away started my studies at the Wine and Spirits Education Trust. Got a job. A friend of mine put me in contact with Peter Gordon, who is probably the most acclaimed New Zealand chef who has in London now several restaurants, but I work with him at the Providors, and I work there in Marylebone High Street, and that was fantastic because I knew nothing about New Zealand and Australian wines, and that was the focus of the restaurant. And then I needed a change, and I went to work as an assistant sommelier at the FATAC outside of London.
FATAC, how was that?
It was extraordinary.
You heard so many stories about Heston Blumenthal. And
he's a brilliant person. He's a brilliant person, an extraordinary, talented chef, and probably one of the smartest people I ever met.
Yeah.
appreciating the art of dining at the highest level. And believe me, I see greatness from, you know, and good kebab to, you know, a 3 Michelin star restaurants all the way through. I think, you know, every single concept and every single restaurant, when it's done right, is amazing. But I am I'm a romantic guy, you know, and I think that there is a charm behind fine dining that should be preserved, and I have a lot of joy out of it.
Mm.
You know, I think there is a skill, there is a craft behind fine dining that unfortunately is becoming rare, and we are losing it because we are living in a really fast world.
Mm.
A really fast society where it seems all of a sudden that we don't have time enough to spend 4 hours with people who you care for and you love to dine and talk and enjoy fine wine and fine food. And, you know, I like that.
Mm.
I like to give time to great things in life. There are a lot of great restaurants out there, but I might have to tell you that 11 Madison Park in New York.
Mm.
I last time I was there, I think it was in 2011, and that is probably one of the greatest fine dining experience I have, one of the greatest expression of fine detail, precision, and the first moment that you put your feet in, you know, you feel this amazing energy that very few places can make that happen. Mm. They did it all the way through, and food is extraordinary, highest level possible. And service is exquisite as, you know, as you can expect it, and everything was seamless. It was fantastic. That's, to me, remaining one of the greatest experiences. And, you know, it's vividly in my memory because it wasn't that long ago, only 3 years, right? But it's still shining there, you know?
Wow, amazing.
Yeah.
And after Fatak, you moved to New York and you started to work at Veritas. Was that the first restaurant in New York?
No, actually. When I moved to New York, in the beginning of 2005, I worked in London with Brad Farmery, a great chef who original from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, moved back to New York, to the States, in New York. We were in contact and he told me, dude, if you want to come to New York, come and work with me. We will arrange everything for you, working visa and all of that, which, as you know, it's really complicated. It's a tedious process. So I say, great, you know, perfect. Let's do this. So I started working with him, and, you know, we went through the process of opening 2 new restaurants at the Public, a great wine bar called the Money Room, and a restaurant called Apple Crown, and I was together for about 4 years with this restaurant group, Avoco. I left in 2009 and I wanted to take a break, and I wanted to learn more directly about viticulture, vinification, and moved to France for about 6-8 months, and I traveled a little bit through France, Germany, Italy, Spain, visiting some producers and such, and then I worked for about half a year as an intern at Domaine Saint-Cumbrèche in Alsace.
You have a lot of wines from them in your cellar here.
I do, because...
Is it because of you, or is it because of earlier something?
Yes, because they had already wines from them, of course, but I add a few more selections because I consider some of their wines to be among the best wines in the world, period. Easy as that.
It's good, yeah.
You know, and that's one of the reasons why I want to work there.
Mm.
That was one. And the second, because Olivier Humbrecht, I don't know if you met him, but if you have the opportunity to meet him, you will realize that he's probably one of the most knowledgeable, inspiring people in the wine industry. It is unbelievable. An hour with him, it will give you knowledge that would you not get from, you know, hours of reading a great book. He's amazing. He was the first master of wine, French. He was a master of wine in 1989. The first French master of wine. So he has a wide understanding and knowledge of wine. It is today one of the greatest experiences I ever had in my life.
How long did you stay there?
About 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Back to New York after that. And then was when I got a position as a sommelier at Veritas, working under the legend Tim Kopeck. And then
another stunning cellar to take care of.
Well, that's something else. I mean, I will never in my life work with something like that. You know, that I know.
How many bottles do they have in this cellar?
Okay, this was a unique restaurant. You know, at the time, it was two restaurants in New York that were kind of the same, but unique around the world. I would say one was Cru. And the other one was Veritas, right? And both restaurants were created from the private cellars of some of the largest wine collectors in the United States and in the world. So basically, these extraordinary wine collectors have decided to open their collections and put them in the cellars for those, in the cellar of the restaurant, in this case Veritas, for everybody to enjoy. So you were talking at the time of, you know, having over, 150,000 bottles or something like that available. Were not all at the restaurant, of course, but, you know, that was the stock you could draw from. And when I first started working there, I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, I think today about that, and I kind of still, I say, like, oh my God, this was really happening at the time. I mean, we were having, like, you know, verticals of, you know, I mean, you know, Romane Conti back to the 1920s, you know, Rumiere, Musigny back to the 50s, you know, Beauvais the same. I mean, producers, Armand Rousseau, Chambertin back to the 1919, you know, things like that. And the same goes to, you know, I don't know, you know, Bordeaux to the same period, you know, Rhones to the same period. I mean, like, all the classic regions were represented within the same depth. I mean, it's incredible, amazing. I was there for 3 years and tasting wines that I probably never gonna taste again in my life, you know, and I'm only gonna dream and remember about it.
So what made you quit? Why did you leave? Because you left New York then, got back to Europe.
Well, I left to come here.
Yeah, exactly. That's my question.
Well, was I mean, it I
family business, love.
Yeah, huh? yeah. Was a family decision. Mm. Was a mutual decision that you know, we decided that was a good time for us to make that change. Mm. Basically,
make it clear. Your wife, your girlfriend, she's from Sweden.
My wife is from Sweden.
Your wife?
Yeah, so that was the trigger.
Mm.
My wife got, you know, a very good interesting job proposal that we consider, and we consider as well our perspective in life. Mm. You know, we both, my wife and I, wanted to at some point to come back to Europe, and we always thought that we wanted to raise a family. And
you just started.
Yes, exactly. And
congratulations. You said before, 3 months old daughter.
Yeah, exactly.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. We are really happy, and we try to look to the world with open minds and open eyes. And there are extraordinary things to be enjoyed anywhere you are.
Mm.
You know, New York is not the end of the world. And, you know, living in Småland, it can be in many ways equally as exciting as living in New York.
Do you have your own wine cellar collection?
Yeah, I have a few wines. I do not too many because living in New York, moving around as much as I do, it makes it very difficult for you to store wines, you know. So during my tenure in London and New York, I was very much buying wines to consume. And that's one of the greatest things as well of living in a place like New York and London. You walk down the street to your wine shop, and you can end up leaving the shop with a great bottle of, you know, whatever, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, you name it, or, you know, new release. So I was buying a lot of wines and I was drinking them.
Mm.
I do, however, now have a cellar, and I have, you know, I have a couple of cellars, as a matter of fact. Two places where I keep wines. It's very tiny still because I haven't been buying wine to keep for so long, but it is something that I am doing more profusely right now. And
what wine do you keep?
I love Burgundy. Unfortunately, Burgundy has become so expensive that I cannot really afford them as I did in the past anymore. It's very sad, but, you know, buying Burgundy 5-10 years ago was half the price. And, you know, it has become a really tricky, really, really tricky to be able to afford any Burgundy. I buy a lot of Northern Rhone, Cornas, and, not a lot, because, you know, Cornas also has become kind of pricey for some of the producers that, you know, we like to have and drink. San Josef quite a bit.
There you can still do a few bargains,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
But it's just such a huge appellation.
Exactly. But, you know, there are some really talented people there that doing really serious Syrah. Cross Hermitage, there are a couple of things there as well that you can buy and you can enjoy. It's Chablis. I don't buy any white Burgundy. I do very little, but for the same reasons as red Burgundy. So my focus is a lot of Chablis, you know, in that sense, and I really do love Chablis. I like some producers a lot in the Loire Valley. Certain Chenin Blancs I like very much.
Any specific producer?
I like a lot Bouvray, if I want a delicate and crystalline style of Chenin. And, you know, I have a really soft spot for, you know, Fourreau style, for instance, you know, very classic. And I think his one is tremendous. You know, if I want a richer style, I tend to lean towards Anjou, Savenier, you know, Domaine du Clossel or something like that. Some Cabernet Francs also I like very much. I didn't always look for
also wine. From Loire.
Yeah, you know, exactly. To me, if there's one producer that I could be happy to drink in the rest of my life, obviously it is the ones from Foucault, Claude Rougeard, you know. So we do have them here, which is great. And there is a really talented grower in the Loire, in Bourgogne, called Jenny Camigo, that produces very pure, direct, elegant and fresh and crisp style of Cabernet Franc that are absolutely fantastic. I mean, Drouet, if you want a bit more rustic style, more traditional, they're beautiful as well. And there are a lot of great people out there in the Loire. But yeah, you know, the ones that are affordable, they deliver, they're great. So I go there. I mean, I love Tuscany, for instance, Sangiovese, traditional style. I like crisp, high acid driven wines, and Sangiovese delivers, you know. I like wines that they are driven by subtlety. I like wines that are driven by finesse, driven by freshness, by elegance. I don't like loud wines. I don't like loud things in life. I don't like showy things, you know. And wine is... And in Spain, I'm trying to look for wines that are driven by the same... qualities.
Are there any hidden treasures in Spain? Or in grapes, or blends, or styles to be...
Well, I don't believe today there is really any hidden treasures anywhere. We live in such a global world that... You know, it takes 1 second for somebody to just post something on Facebook or Instagram, and it is not a secret anymore.
But are there any regions in Spain that you would like to push or put a light on?
I do, certainly. I mean, there are many of them. But I do certainly believe that some of the greatest wines will be produced and are produced today in the northwest of Spain. Yeah, you know, Ribera Sacra, Bierzo and such. That's, to me, one of the most attractive regions in Spain. But Spain is a country as well that is it's been changing for the past 35 years, you know, constantly. In many different ways, politically, and that involves socially elements and economically elements, and that affects the way you're making wine also. Everything is interconnected. And there are a lot of new, there's a new generation of producers in Spain as well that are also well-traveled, that are really knowledgeable, that they have a really wide scope of looking at wine, and that they are very open-minded and they are producing really exciting things. And I see in the near future many changes happening in Spain, in any regions, from Rías Baixas to Jerez to Ribera del Duero, Rioja, Priorat, you name it. So, yeah, it's a really exciting country. I like very traditional Spanish wines as well. You know, I do tremendously. Traditional Riojas and pseudo-traditional Riojas, because it's very interesting. The modern wines that appeared in the early 90s in Spain, you know, the modern Riojas called at the time, today they're classics.
Yeah.
And they're great wines. And they're really old school wines. They are coming back, which is fantastic because I always love them, you know. I think Ribera del Duero, there is a lot to watch there. There's some young growers pushing the envelope and making exciting wines also. We'll be right back.
this kind of little test. Mm. If I say Rioja or Ribera del Duero, you just pick one of them. You say, okay, so we just start. Beaujolais or Dolcetto?
Beaujolais.
Moselle or Rheingau?
Moselle.
Young wine or mature?
Mature.
Galloni or Parker? Quick. Yeah, I know.
This is a controversial question.
I mean, Galloni been working for Parker, so they are not.
Exactly,
but, now they're competitors.
Exactly.
Do you follow any wine magazine? Otherwise.
Yes. I'm subscribed to the World of Fine Wine.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I kind of like to read as a wine magazine.
Mm. Because yeah. I had another question here. Is it Decanter or Wine Spectator?
They are both great.
Mm. You're very democratic. Okay, Napa or Santa Barbara?
That's really tough also. Some of the greatest red wines I have so far, you know, which by the time Santa Barbara was not quite developed yet in the sense it is today, are coming from Napa. I would say Napa. I agree, Napa is fantastic.
Mm.
But I think, you know, when you say Napa, you have a certain maybe connotation about Napa Valley, right?
Exactly.
Which is probably not what I'm referring to.
Okay, we continue. Sweet or strong?
You know, I love sherry, and that's a fortified wine, so...
Strong.
Strong.
House wine or tap beer?
House wine.
Tasting notes or tasting memories?
Both.
Do you write tasting notes?
I do. I do a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. For many, many years, I always had... the smallest moleskin you can, they produce, it's a tiny one, which is, you know, like 10 centimeters. And so it fits, it's very thin and it fits perfectly in your inner pocket of your jacket. So I have a group of moleskins with, you know, tasting notes of wines that are really helpful now for me to go back and look at it.
Do you have any specific order or category?
No? It's used by date.
By date, so you try to remember when you tasted it. And then
so every I did it every day.
Mm.
So at the end of the service, I was just sitting down and write my notes about the ones that I opened.
So yeah, both tasting notes and tasting memories.
Yeah.
New Zealand or Australia?
Oh, that's also a tough one. I would say cool climate, Australia, and Central Otago, New Zealand. How about that?
No, that's a more specific answer. Hungary or Austria?
I would say Hungary for sweets and Austria for dry.
Okay. Cava or Prosecco?
Cava.
This might be a tough one. Rioja or Ribera del Duero?
You're killing me here. I couldn't choose.
Oh.
I love them both.
It's all right. Dry or off-dry Riesling?
It really depends. Mm. For me, Riesling is one of the greatest varieties in the world that produce extraordinary wines in the whole range of spectrum of sweetness.
Best
to sweet. Mm. I think they can be beautiful both, yeah.
The last one is pretty easy, I think. Champagne breakfast or wine lunch?
Both.
Exactly. Today is Saturday, and you are actually going home to your family.
Yes.
You're not working tonight.
No, I'm going down south. I'm going to Skåne. Yeah.
So, what wine would you bring home?
Well, you know, I believe my mother-in-law is gonna cook some deer, right?
Oh, okay.
You know, they get some meat from the hunters around, and I have a little bit of wine down there, and I haven't really made my mind yet, but it could be something either from the Northern Rhone, or it could be maybe. If I want something a little bit richer, I might have even to turn south to Spain and maybe even a Ribera del Duero. Why not?
Why not? If you should pick a bottle from the cellar to the dinner tonight, what would you bring? Would you bring something like that as well? Or if you have, okay, pick whatever you want for dinner.
Well, I might pick an old Bordeaux, an old Figeac, for instance, you know, like an 83 Figeac. It would be
Magnum
is always the way to roll, you know, even if you are by yourself, you know, Magnum is the way to roll, yes.
Good, and it's a family bottle.
Well, that's a general one.
Okay, sorry. What vintage are you? When were you born?
77.
Tricky year.
Really tricky.
Nice vintage port.
Correct. Quite good Californian.
Yeah.
Actually, you find good 77 red Californians. Californian are quite quite good, actually. Bordeaux was terrible. Burgundy, forget about that. Really good year in Chianti, in Tuscany, in 77, actually. I love Chianti Classico. It's another of the, we were talking about forgotten regions. The Classico area and some other areas within Chianti, like Colli Senesi, you know.
Do you have any other favorite producers of Chianti Classico?
Montevergine is one of my way to go's. Felsina I like very much, you know. I like the work of Elisabetta Fagioli in not in the Classico area, but a little bit in the Colli Senesi area, there, which is tremendous. La Porta di Bertini, in I think they are located in Greve. They're fantastic. I mean, there are a lot of great wine coming out, and it's another region to explore because the prices are really affordable today still, and Sangiovese can be tremendous.
So thanks for having me here. I'm gonna go down soon and eat dinner. Is there anything especially I should look for in the wine list, or is there any combination that people
I would suggest to put your hands put yourself on the hands of Johan Nielsen? He will be taking care of you tonight, and he's a fantastic sommelier. And he will be working tonight with also Ulrike Baumann, who is a phenomenal maître d'. And I would say just be brave and adventurous, and let yourself just, you know, be taken care of by them.
I will, definitely. So, what are we drinking? I almost forgot about that. We had to make a... You do the conclusion.
All right. So, when you first served the wine, I really, you know, I was overtaken by the perfume of it, And we both agreed that it's a wine made from grapes that, you know, they are fairly delicate, not a lot of tannins, there's not a lot of color and such. And, you know, so we are in the kind of Pinot Noirish family. And for a bit of time, I was, particularly when the wine was cooler, you know, when the acidity was fresher and the alcohol was not so marked, I even considered to be in the old world. You know, I thought it could be even Grenache, because I think that the grapes that this wine is made from come from an area where there is a good amount of sun. And there is a good amount of warmth. It's not a cool climate wine. Or if it is, it comes from a warm vintage. So I thought it could be maybe something from Genodic Rana's family, coming from the southern Rhone. I was even being in Spain, in certain, you know, even Rana's high altitude or, you know, some other grape varieties. But as the wine started to open up, and as the time the wine started to, you know, to warm up even more, due to its, you know, relatively warm spike of alcohol, soft tannins, ripe fruit character, obviously, you know, the perfume, quality fruit that you expect from Pinot Noir and such, you know, it kind of took me all the way across the Atlantic to California Pinot. And
who's thinking?
You know, and I was kind of more into, it's hard to nail it down, but maybe Sonoma Coast or, you know, some sort of a coolish area within California, because there is a sense of refinement in the wine still that takes you and speaks about, you know, cool climate within a reasonable, you know, cool climate area.
Very, very, very well put. And I mean, your conclusion is spot on, except you should, instead of travel that way, go the other way to New Zealand.
Where in New Zealand?
We're in New Zealand.
All right.
It's a warm climate, arid. We are in Martinborough.
Martinborough, right.
So we are not in central Otago, because that used to be quite more crisp acidity. Not that really cold vintage. It's 2010.
Who's the producer, by the way?
It's Martinborough Vineyards.
Oh, it's one of the greatest, yeah. Classic, absolutely. I mean, Martinborough is one of the first vineyards, one of the first estates established in, of course, Martinborough, really. Tremendous. Haven't tasted their wines for a while. I work a lot in the past with them, actually, and it's great. Fabulous. Thank you very much for bringing that.
I'm not sure if they're making vineyard site wines.
I don't think so, no. They do a Chardonnay, which is also pretty good. They do this Pinot. I believe they do Pinot Gris as well, and it might be even do a Riesling. I don't recall it, but not single vineyard ones. No.
They're not so much about that. It's more in central Otago. They try to make vineyard wines, and it still is quite difficult to feel the difference when it comes to terroir. It's more, to me, it's more easy to find the producer.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alf, and I think that one of the reasons also is because the vineyards are very young. We need another 50 years in New Zealand to be able of that terroir to shine and to really, you know, see the difference so clearly. I also, you know, I thought, okay, you are here in Bequa, you're coming all the way from Stockholm, and you bring in a bottle of wine to share. So, since we have, I realize that we have a couple of things in common. You know, it's our love and passion for wine, but also music.
Yes.
So you brought the wine, and I thought that would be a good idea to bring you the music. Okay.
Good idea.
So I brought you an LP for you here, also blind.
Wow, record.
Of course. It's the only way to roll, man.
Wow. So thank you very much.
So, I mean, it's very random, obviously, to, it's like you know, to pick a bottle of wine.
What the hell
I'm going to pick. But I brought a record for you. Also.
And it's in a brown bag. I like that.
It is from a store in San Francisco. Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. You might ever have it. I don't know.
No, I don't have it. Indian to the Plateau of Mirror. Harold, Bud, and Brian Eno. But this is a rare record.
It is an American edition. And I'm also DJ a little bit sometimes, you know, not as much as you do. But I'm really much into, you know, electronic music, of course, and I'm very much into all sort of kind of experiments and ambient music.
Yeah,
also
he's
from
like the godfather of electronic music.
Uh-huh. So, you know, he started to produce ambient music in 1975 when he was in the hospital and such, and this is the second release of his ambient series. And, you know, I have two copies of it. I'm going to bring you one.
Thank you very much.
Hoping that you don't have one already.
No, I don't. And let's finish this podcast with just listen to it.
That would be awesome.
So what should we drink to this? Maybe it's just another bottle.
Yeah, we should go now to Burgundy.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Nej, men se där, det där var ju alldeles förträffligt härligt att återuppleva mötet med Ruben där nere på PM. Har ni vägarna förbi Växjö så missa inte. Ta in, käka en middag på PM, snacka med Ruben och beställ någonting från den fantastiska vinlistan. När ni är där, håll även utkik efter en annan mycket begåvad sommelier, Johan Nilsson, som blev nordisk mästare här för ett tag sedan. Han ska jag också försöka ta ett snack med. Men mer om det senare. Ha det bra. Tja.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.